Just like in 2017, Macron is likely to face calls that his victory is not a mandate for his proposed policies, such as raising the retirement age this fall. That means the country is likely to experience continued social unrest, which was unprecedented in Macron's first term. France's political future usually first surfaces in their neo-imperial colonies, like with the Yellow Vests. For the first time, the far right won most of France's overseas territories in what could be a preview of 2027. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
Recent deadly attacks in Afghanistan have left Afghan families grieving. Some have lost their parents, and some their children. Here, we are meeting the family of Shahid Melad, who was killed in Tuesday's school bombing in Kabul. Melad's mother can't speak, as she is in a flood of tears, mourning the loss of her young son. But his disabled father managed to speak with great sorrow.
Melad was a very diligent boy. It was his last year at school. He was preparing himself to enter university. He used to tell me that he was going to become a doctor and make a living so that his father doesn't have to work. He wished to serve his family and society, but unfortunately they took him from us.
In another alley in Hazara neighborhood, another family is mourning the death of a father. After the attack on school students, Mir Hussain went to bring his son home, but he himself fell victim to the second explosion.
My brother was on the roof when he heard a bomb explosion at the school. He quickly went to school to find his son Mahdi. He was searching around when the second explosion occurred. He was injured in the attack, but later at the hospital, we lost him forever.
Mahdi has survived the attack, but he is struggling with the shock of the attack and the pain of losing his father. Likewise, in the west of Kabul, there are many families whose beloved ones are either killed or wounded. They feel despaired and can't hold back their tears. It remains to be seen if the time can heal their wounds. These days, Afghan families want peace and security. People here say they're terrified of repeated blind terror attacks. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A big rally was held in the besieged Gaza Strip to support Al-Quds in the face of rising Israeli aggression against the Holy City. Thousands of people from all walks of life came out to express their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli attacks. Tensions have been on the rise in recent days as extremist Israeli settlers, backed by Israeli regime forces, desecrated the city's Al-Aqsa Mosque. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and slammed the silence of Arab countries towards the Israeli crimes. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the Friday rally, warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
We will not leave Al-Quds as a prey for the Zionist enemy, and our people are united today in defending Al-Quds. The Palestinian resistance is very strong and will defend Al-Quds against Zionist attacks. Today's rally and the masses here are sending a strong message to the Zionist enemy. If these Zionist attacks against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque don't come to an end, our people will explode in the face of the Zionist entity.
Since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, the Israeli forces and illegal settlers have been trying to prevent Palestinians from gathering and performing their religious duties at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state.
We are here today to show our solidarity and support for Al-Quds in the face of Zionist aggressions. All Palestinian resistance groups are here to send a message of unity. We will spare no effort to protect Al-Quds, and we call on all Arabs and Muslims to support the resistance and help us to protect Al-Quds and the Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians have expressed their willingness to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Islam's holy book, the Quran, is the theme of this expo. Held every year in the fasting month of Ramadan, the International Quran Exhibition opened its doors after 2 years of hiatus, driven by the coronavirus pandemic. Now, the 29th edition of the event has brought here exhibitors from Iran and other Muslim countries to present their religious products. While the expo displays exquisite copies of the Quran, it also gives a chance to IT firms to showcase online versions of the Holy Book, among other religious apps and software. The art section is one of the popular parts of the event. It features paintings, calligraphy works, and conceptual artworks, all themed with the Quran. The holy month of Ramadan is believed to be the month when the holy book of Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad some 14 centuries ago. That's why this exhibition is held during the holy month, which is also referred to as the month of Quran.
Every Muslim family has a copy of the Quran in their houses to read its verses and ponder its divine messages as many times as possible during the year, and especially in Ramadan, as the month of the Quran's revelation to the Prophet. Now, one of the major goals of this expo is to promote the instructions of the Divine Book, especially among the younger generation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Braving the scorching heat while fasting, protesters took to the streets after Friday prayers across Pakistan to voice solidarity with Palestinians as tension continued to simmer in the occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli forces once again attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Protesters here are outraged over what they call the double standards of the international community and the way they view Ukraine compared to Palestine.
Double standards is the biggest issue with international community. East Timor, South Sudan, Kashmir, Palestine, you name it. When Muslims are victims, they will always turn their backs on us. Therefore, I think it's about time to put an end to this collective behavior against Muslims on international stage.
Actually, we are, being a Muslim, Al-Aqsa, the Muslims over there are brothers and sisters. If they're in pain, we are feeling the same pain in our body. The whole Muslim Ummah is like a one body. If one part feels is in pain, the whole body feels the pain. So we are feeling that pain, and we are gathered here to tell the world that they are not alone. We are with them.
Speakers at the rally stressed upon the need of unity among the Muslim world.
People are who are gathered over here because of, as you know, the situation which is going on in Palestine. Israelis are continuously terrorizing or they're attacking the innocent people of Palestine. That's why we are gathering in the protest to show their solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Again, you know, the Jews, army and the military, paramilitary forces, they are not letting the Muslims over there freely praying and offering their rituals of the Ramadan. And everybody knows this is the holiest month of Ramadan, and this is very sacred to the Muslim.
The Israeli aggression against Palestinians has once again escalated during the fasting month of Ramadan. Scores of Palestinians have been injured by the Israeli forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque over the past few days. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Amid ongoing violence in Palestine, hundreds of London protesters mobbed outside Israel's embassy to condemn the regime's ongoing onslaught. The Islamic holy site in the occupied capital Jerusalem, Al-Quds, has been targeted with daily raids by not just regime forces, but also Zionist fanatics who seek to desecrate Islam's second holiest site during Ramadan, the holiest month for Muslims.
I struggle to comprehend how human beings can do this to others. You know, it's occupation, but for the numbers of people that are happy to use their hate to hit and kill people, the anger that I feel and the sadness and the heartache for the Palestinians, it's difficult.
The unrest also sparked hostilities between Gaza-based Palestinian resistance fighters and Israeli regime forces as the two sides exchanged fire early on Thursday. The lack of mainstream media attention, despite the shocking footage which has emerged, has equally infuriated many onlookers.
It's not just me. Every Palestinian have been hit with the fact that international law is very selective. The application of international law depends on the interests of these countries. And, you know, the major powers insist to keep putting Israel above the law, to keep shielding Israel from international scrutiny and international sanctions. And if this does anything, it actually exposes that the world is not serious about its own rules and laws.
This isn't the first time that the Israeli regime has conducted acts of aggression against Muslims during the holy month of Ramadan in occupied Palestine. However, global awareness of Israel's crimes is at an all-time high, and with future protest action planned over the next days and weeks here in London, the global reaction to what's been going on is far from over. Robert Carter, London.
Whispers with God on a night that's believed by Muslims to be a time when their wishes are fulfilled. It's called Laylatul Ghadr, or the Night of Destiny. Muslims observe the occasion every year in the month of Ramadan, when they congregate at religious sites to pray and make wishes. To Iranians, no place is better than the shrine of the 8th Shia Imam Reza in the city of Mashhad to keep vigil on the occasion.
Words cannot describe my feelings tonight. It's a night of destiny when God has promised to listen to our prayers. It's a night which the Quran says is better than 1,000 months. I'm so happy to be in Imam Reza's shrine on this divine night.
After 2 years, we once again can visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, our beloved Imam, and that on the night of destiny. I wish that God will eradicate the coronavirus once and for all, for us to be able to live peacefully and visit our holy sites.
Islamic scriptures say Laylatul Ghadr marks the night when the Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad. The Quran says on this night, angels descend on earth to listen to the prayers of worshippers.
We believe that on the night of destiny, angels come to earth upon God's order. The Quran says in its verses that the book was revealed to the Prophet on this night, and the angels will stay on earth till dawn. That's why we never miss out on this holy night and come here to pray.
No exact date is provided for the Night of Destiny, but all Islamic references are unanimous that the Quran was revealed to the Prophet on one of three different dates, the 19th, the 21st, or the 23rd night of the holy month of Ramadan.
It's the first time after more than 2 years that the Night of Destiny is marked without serious concerns over the coronavirus. And this has attracted this huge number of pilgrims to the shrine of Imam Reza to once again mark Laylatul Ghadr en masse and at the same time reunite with their 8th Imam after 2 years. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
Violence, oppression, and desecration of holy sites. Just more of the Ramadan reminders that Palestinians continue to live under occupation and suffer daily injustices. More than ever, international solidarity, especially in an age of social media, is important. With the atrocities being committed against Palestinians, raising awareness and exhibiting support is more crucial than before. This year's Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is giving millions across the world the opportunity to show solidarity by displaying a Palestinian flag in person or online.
If we are not able to stand up at this hour of need and be supportive to those Palestinians by holding a flag on our car, on our shops, on our homes, then what are we good for? And when are we going to do this? And I think what I have seen, ordinary people responding so fantastically.
In the lead up to the annual Al-Quds rally in the British capital, the global support for the campaign is in full swing.
Organizers are encouraging participation in this year's event, and taking part could not be more simple. First of all, please post your image or your footage online, encourage a few friends to do the same, and of course, use the hashtag.
As the global solidarity movement grows, so does the opposition, a fact not lost on pro-Palestine campaigners.
We got ministers coming and saying, you know, they're going to refer us to the police for saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. It's outrageous. These are the same people that actually articulate that freedom of speech is absolute, and you know they go on and on. What's wrong with any part of the world to be free? What's wrong with asking people to be free?
So organizers are urging you to do your part. Lift your voice in solidarity and fly the flag for Palestine. Amina Taylor, London.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that Imam Khomeini authored the book Kashful Asrar in response to the misleading book 1000 Year Secrets, which had been written by Ali Akbar Hakamizadeh, an erstwhile student of seminary who left for the US while no more wearing the costume of clergymen. It was said that Imam Khomeini's book can be considered as the starting point of his struggles against the Pahlavi regime and his endeavor to establish the Islamic rule. Today, we are going to dwell upon that part of the Imam's struggles which were against the Shah's so-called White Revolution. As usual, the narrator is mainly Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi. After the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Hossein Borujerdi in 1961, Iran's Shah, Mohammad Reza, thought that one of the main obstacles against his anti-religious moves and consolidation of his tyrannical rule had gone. Therefore, he started fighting off Islam and ulema very seriously and openly. However, his dream was very soon shattered by Imam Khomeini's uprising, which fell upon him like a nightmare. The Imam raised the banner of a struggle against the regime and its main supporter, the US, opening a new chapter in the political and religious atmosphere of the country. Imam Khomeini's wife narrates, "The Imam was a wise, clever, and religious man. After the demise of Ayatollah Borujerdi, he staged uprising against the Shah apparatus, which wanted to set aside religion and march in the path of the West. As he was a very religious and devoted person, whenever the religion and religiosity were mocked at, it was as if his children had been beheaded in front of him. After the late Borujerdi, the Shah intended to set aside clergymen and religion in Iran forever. Of course, he had made the decision at the time of late Borujerdi, but his power wouldn't let the Shah do such a thing. In those days, the man of politics and the field of a struggle against the regime was Ayatollah Kashani, and Mr. Khomeini was acquainted with him, but there was not a political relation in the modern sense, and, as I have said, the Imam's main job was studying and discussion."
Thank you.
Imam Khomeini had a positive opinion on the struggles of Ayatollah Kashani, although he had some critical views too. The Imam's wife continues, "My father said that when Mr. Kashani had seen Mr. Ruhullah for the first time, he told my father, 'Where have you found this prodigy? He's a good base for the future.'" Mr. Khomeini liked Mr. Kashani's struggles generally and would go to his house too. But it was not that much to say that he had a role in late Kashani's political establishment. After late Borujerdi, the Imam, besides studying and discussion, had become a source of emulation himself and considered himself responsible before events. Thus, he couldn't be silent against deviations and believed that silence against oppression is a bigger oppression. In the winter of 1963, the American President John F. Kennedy advised the Shah to implement the so-called reforms, calling it the White Revolution, or the Revolution of the Shah and the People. This measure comprised issues which were seemingly useful, such as land reforms, granting the right to vote to women, and giving shares of the profits of factories to workers. But the Shah's main aim was to bolster the foundation of his despotic rule and destroying strong social forces such as the clergymen and landowners. Ms. Sagafi says, "In 1963, the government decided to do some reforms. Although it was not that important, it implied issues which would make them important. The Imam believed that the Shah had taken the first step cautiously, but his next steps would be serious danger for Islam and the country's independence. Therefore, he couldn't be silent against the Shah anti-religious moves." Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Sagafi, referring to her protest to the Imam as why he was the only one among the ulema and sources of emulation to oppose the Shah's plan, says, "The Imam felt his duty in this regard and considered himself accountable before God. I told him, 'Why do other ulema and sources of emulation not protest and it is only you who feel the duty?' He answered, 'I don't bother them, lady. By God, I am responsible. If you are ready to see God punishing me on the judgment day, tell me to keep silent.'" So I was sure that the Imam had a mission which he had to fulfill. Therefore, I always tried to pave the ground for his activity. Imam Khomeini's courageous and explicit opposition to the Shah's so-called referendum infuriated the latter, and there were rumors of arresting the Imam. Yet Imam Khomeini was so calm and unmoved. Ms. Sagafi narrates as follows: "The morning gatherings and narrations of Imam Hussein's tragedy were different from those of the previous years. Little by little, these narrations were finding their true meaning, which was the memory of martyrs and combatants of the path of freedom and religion. They had gradually changed from amusement and stupor to movement and awareness. Preachers had turned the issue from the state of stupor and would prepare the people for resistance against all tortures and torments. Preparation for uprising, the uprising like Hussein by his descendant Khomeini. When the rumor prevailed on Imam Khomeini's arrest, one night he told me, 'If they arrest me, do not be anxious.' I told him jokingly, 'That's good, as I will breathe for a while.' In the advent of his struggles, the Imam would tell Ahmad, 'Tonight they may arrest me. Don't fear. If they come and arrest me, don't do anything. Don't seek help from anyone to relieve me. Even do not accept anyone's money for livelihood.'"
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The French presidential election has drawn to a close. The incumbent Emmanuel Macron was chosen for a second term, but in several cities, including in Paris, his re-election has triggered riots and protests instead of celebrations and joy. Why would there be such a reaction, and why would the elections have one of the lowest turnouts in decades? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the far right has narrowed the gap with Macron, whether that would pose problems for Macron in the upcoming parliamentary elections, and what Macron means when he says he would change his system of governance.
French President Emmanuel Macron has been re-elected in a comfortable victory, defeating the National Rally's Marine Le Pen, just like in 2017. 6 years after Brexit and the election of Donald Trump, France has still not had a shock victory which opposes right-wing economics and globalization. Macron's victory will be celebrated by high finance in Brussels and by the so-called bourgeois bloc, who are his core supporters. However, the Yellow Vests have said for months that they view a Macron victory as intolerable and as a call to social battle.
We had 3 years of a struggle but couldn't get Macron out of power. It shows that there is no solution possible by the ballot. Only on the streets, many people will be quite desperate, so things could turn towards extreme social instability and maybe civil war.
Le Pen did see a major rise in support as compared with 2017, but the nationalist bloc still fell short. It seems that many voters simply could not vote in favor of even a rebranded National Front, whose far-right record goes back decades. Abstention hit 28%, the highest since 1969, Blank or purposely spoiled ballots are estimated to be an additional 12%. The populist bloc, who apparently wanted neither candidate, made their presence felt by denying Macron a convincing victory in terms of the overall electorate.
The biggest revolution to come will be philosophical and intellectual. We need a new way of thinking, a new way of being French, and we need a new France. With Le Pen or Macron, we were sure to lose our democratic rights and personal freedoms, and that's unacceptable to many.
Just like in 2017, Macron is likely to face calls that his victory is not a mandate for his proposed policies, such as raising the retirement age this fall. That means the country is likely to experience continued social unrest, which was unprecedented in Macron's first term. France's political future usually first surfaces in their neo-imperial colonies, like with the Yellow Vests. For the first time, the far right won most of France's overseas territories in what could be a preview of 2027. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
Well, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Mustapha Traoré joins us. He's an academic and political commentator who joins us from Paris. Also joining us is Ian Williams, international affairs analyst, who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, welcome to you both. Mustapha Traoré, I'm going to start with you first, since you're in Paris there. We know Macron won, obviously, but it's worth taking a look at the way that these votes came in and the significance. Looking at, for example, some of the stats on this, this abstention rate was recorded to be the highest since the year 1969, which is what I'd like to ask you as to why you think that is. And you also have a sizable number of the voters who refused to vote for either of the two leading contenders. Again, your answer on that.
Yes, of course. Yes, so the third thing is that we had the same elections that we had 5 years ago. People are a bit disappointed. They've got the feeling that they were stolen their right to express their voice. Okay, and so that was the case 5 years ago. There's a repetition this year. So I think this is one of the main reasons for the high rate of people who decided to not to vote for these elections. And so Macron, we know what he's going to do. And those who voted for Macron, if you analyze it, if you ask, if you try to investigate on the people who voted for him, we'll find that lots of people voted for him because they did not want Marine Le Pen to become the president of the country. So it was more a vote against Marine than a vote for Macron. And if we analyze it, the situation, I think, is that Macron is going just to carry on the same policies he's been doing since he was elected. He's got no reason to change anything because it works for him. And according to the French law, a candidate or a president can be elected just twice. So you have the right of, you have two mandates. There is no reason for him to change. This is going to be his last mandate.
Yeah, we're gonna.
Yeah,
we're
and he's got a wide card.
Okay.
Wide card to put into place all kind of policies.
Sure, we're going to challenge you on that, hopefully, and see where we can go with that. Ian Williams, again, we're breaking down the way that these votes came in and its significance. And one of the things that our guest there talked about is how people came out to vote for Macron as to not have Le Pen win. At the same time, and I'm merging these two questions, you have the gap between the two rivals to have halved since 2017. And at the same time, you're having many to move to the far right. So we don't go through each specific result here. What do these mean in terms of the way that it would affect France, in terms of the electorate, in terms of the French? Ian Williams.
Well, I'm increasingly wondering just how relevant the definitions of left and right are across the Western world, because they seem to be detached from economics. Here we have a right-wing candidate in France, and you could say to some extent Farage and Trump are capitalizing on the discontents of the dispossessed, the unemployed, the people in the Rust Belt, the people in the countryside. They're appealing to them. This is the traditional territory of the left. It's interesting. There's an inversion, and the right has often successfully managed to make cultural issues. So the big issue in France is partly the fact that pensions are being taken off people and they're losing work, but also they've managed to divert the whole issue to whether Muslim women wear hijabs in public or not. It's a bit like in the US, where the whole issue of gay and transphobic elements, it takes a wholly disproportionate role. Which bathroom do you use? So it doesn't matter if you're starving, it doesn't matter if you don't have a job, it doesn't matter if you're dying because you don't get health service, but it's very important that that people use the right bathrooms. And it's similar in France. The cultural issues, the signifying, are filled the gap left by the traditional economics, because the traditional left has walked away. There are no, there's no vision. Without vision, the people will perish. And they have consciously felt, a lot of working people are desperately and genuinely feeling neglected because the government doesn't listen to them. They say that they don't want pensions reduced to 62 if you spent a life working in the coal mines or on ships on the railways. The government doesn't care because the government has accountants. It has calculators that tell them that this is what they have to do to balance the books. But somehow the balance in the books never includes a wealth tax. It never includes hitting the real rich. I don't believe Le Pen is going to do any of those things. But all she has to do is to talk about it to get elected. It's just like Trump. Trump did every one of his policies has favored the plutocrats in right. America. Yeah, he hasn't in any way implemented them, but he gets their votes because he says he's going to. The left doesn't even say that anymore. Joe Biden is, was a creature of the insurance companies of Delaware.
Okay.
And he's a very uninspiring character as well. But, it's the same here with Macron. He is not somebody who you go to the barricades for.
Sure.
You might go to the barricades against, as we're now seeing.
Well, many are saying there's not even a middle anymore. And the ones who were there are moved either to the left or the right. So then it becomes the confusion. But, we need to talk about this, Mostafa Charrier, in France. As you can tell us more than anybody else probably, people matter because French love to protest. They go out to the streets and they want to earn the rights that were given to them. Macron has gone against that. We have seen that throughout the 5 years. More importantly, when you take a look at the stat where it says, for example, not only had 80% of the participants lost trust in all the political parties, 40% no longer felt attached to any movement. How would this be important? Why would this be important for France and for Macron vis-a-vis the variety of things that he wants to enact? Because he says, I'm going to have a new kind of governance.
Yes, so I think you're right when you said that protesting is part of the French DNA. But the thing is that this is not the only thing that is part of the French DNA. Racism as well. So in fact, this is why I think what is happening to France, the only responsible is the French population the voters, because they are those who are buying all these commands, all these stories about hijab, about the veil, and they are buying it, they are watching, they are interested in it. And we must not forget that the score of Marine Le Pen is very high. 41% of the population voted for her. So even if in these 41%, you have people who just wanted the system to collapse, but they still voted for her. So I think that in France is a country of revolution. You have lots of revolutionaries. It's a country where people protest, but at the same time, it is a country with a form of racism that is part of the French mindset. And this is one fact. Macron is very clever. He's playing with it. So they play with it, which means that they boost racist ideologies so that people focus on this one. And then at the end, we have just two candidates. We have Marine Le Pen and Macron. Mm-hmm. Okay, and they could have voted for Mélenchon. Mélenchon is the only one who represents the left today in France. But the thing is that people are not interested. Lots uh-huh. of people prefer, if you look at the Socialist Party, I think the number of votes they got is a shame. That's a shame for a party that used to be one of the main political parties of the country.
Sure.
But how come you have Mélenchon? They could have just joined Mélenchon. Why is it that they're all split like this?
Well, we'll see where the support is going to end up. Let's take a look at some of the economic aspects behind Macron. And one of the things that's truly amazing that Ian Williams, correct me if I'm wrong, many are not grasping what it meant, is the fact that it was advertised that Macron is riding high on an economic GDP growth of 7%. Now, what's not being highlighted is the fact that it dipped negative 7% during the COVID-19 pandemic. And it's a natural increase, which is called a COVID bounce back for countries when they come out of the COVID pandemic, two-year, rest or whatever you want to call it, that's just natural for there to be a large GDP increase. Because if we look at the projections, they go back down to 1.2%, maybe 2%, and tapers off in those areas for the following years. How is Macron going to deal with the French economy with inflation staring him right in the face?
I'm not sure about inflation, but statistics often lie. And in this case, I think people are voting based on their pockets. If they go into the baker's and they can't afford the bread, it's, bread, peace and land. It's an old harbinger of resolution. And they can't all eat cake. Especially they can't get the credit cards to buy the cake. And I think it was interesting because none of the usual paradigms actually hold on a one-to-one basis. It's a very complex equation here. The overseas departments, overwhelmingly black and immigrant, voted overwhelmingly for Le Pen. So Guadeloupe, Martinique and the others. And I saw a quote from a trade unionist I think it was Guadeloupe, who said the protests expressed the depth of suffering, inequality, poverty and exclusion felt by the people. So they feel this, and they're going to hit at whoever's in authority is responsible for this. And none of the people, none of the contenders actually came up with any coherent vision even. I'm not even talking about a plan. There's no idea, we are all in this together. We want to look after our own people. We want to build a health service. We want to build education. We had none of this inspiration, not even the usual fraternity, equality, etc. That it's been argued on statistics and particularly these wedge issues, I call them. Mm-hmm. The wedge issues that people come in, it's the hijab or the gay rights or Europe. And notice Le Pen actually dropped the proposal to move out of the Eurozone not because it wasn't particularly popular with people, but because the people who were going to pay for her election didn't want it, the business people.
Sure.
So, you know, we have all of these factors playing in, and we've somehow got to avoid the old reductionism of left thing that neoliberals did over the years, was to destroy the structures of society. They destroyed the unions, they destroyed the societies, they destroyed the communities and rendered them, you know, useless and voiceless. And that's what we're left with now. And,
okay.
You know, they're scratching their head thinking, oh, look at this, we smashed the house down and it won't build itself. But that's what they've done. They smashed the society down. They smashed those structures. They smashed the solidarity, the collectivist solidarity structures that France was actually very good at.
Okay.
They took the largest communist party in Western Europe and trashed it. The communist party did a lot of that for themselves. But then they did the same for the socialists. But the socialists self-destructed because they adopted chameleon-like. They became conservatives somehow.
Right.
Mélenchon is different. And, you know, under the circumstances,
okay,
he didn't do so badly, but I hope he does better in the future.
Sifting through what I wanted to present to you here, Mostafa Traoré, for a question, I think is best described by this statement by Macron, which shows the depth of the problem that the French are experiencing, unlike how he has been touted for his economic advancements. This is what he has said himself. Quote, our project for 2022, it's solidarity and social progress. French people who work should not have to spend their whole salary filling up their petrol tanks and shopping. That's unfair. So there you have it. He's saying that. Is that how bad it is? Is that what the French are experiencing right now?
Yes, it is. And the predictions for the future are not nice either. The reason why, because we've got the crisis going on in Ukraine, Russia, and also there are lots of crises, small crises, happening in the African continent. And we know that France, the French economy, relies more on the resources they can get from the African continent. Without Africa, France is nothing. It's not just me saying it. It's former President Jacques Chirac who used to say it. Without the former colonies, France is nothing. Okay, France is just exploiting through the African currency, francs CFA, through the gas they have in northern Mali they get for free. The uranium they got from Niger. Niger is one of the poorest countries in the world. But if you look at all the uranium that we use in France, it comes from Niger. So this is, look at all these islands, Guadeloupe, Martinique, all the resources we get from free. I want to say we get from free because I live in France, so I benefit from it as well. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So if now what is happening in the African continent, you have people getting aware of what is going on, protesting, and trying to get their total independence.
Sure.
So which means that if they stop their what we call La France-Afrique, this relationship in which they are exploited by France, if they stop, if they put it to an end, France is going to suffer. And for sure, the price of oil, the price of goods, and so on, and our purchasing power in France is going to be affected.
Sure. Well, he's got to do something rather quickly. I'm not going to ask any more economic related questions here, Ian Williams, because we're running out of time. We're looking at Jean-Luc Mélenchon's voters, and maybe this is coming from a source that is anti-Macron or is a sore loser, maybe. But it's saying that these voters are now going to want to take revenge on Macron, and they're going to show that soon in the parliamentary elections that are coming up. Do you think, given the demographics of the voters, that perhaps Macron is going to have a hard time to hold a majority there in parliament and therefore, consequentially, not be able to enact any reforms. We know he's got this 30 billion euro plan that involves a whole lot of things, but of course that's in the works. Who knows if it's going to really be executed?
I think he's going to have a great deal of problems maintaining a parliamentary majority, because it's a much closer reflection of what's happening in society. Mélenchon might well come into his own there, as opposed to the weird presidential system imposed by Charles de Gaulle on this republic. Quite who's controlling what is always a big problem. But he's going to have problems controlling the parliament, and the parliament is Mélenchon, the socialists, and the other dissidents will be there. And who knows? You might even get the socialists and the National Front united as one against reducing the pension age, because they're both appealing to the same constituency. Yeah. He might have a great deal of difficulty getting it through. But, as we saw with the strikes the other year over the railways, when he tried this, when he tried to get this neoliberal project through, it got a lot of support from general public who, there is a collectivist and dirigist element in France. And Macron is basically saying that the government should butt out, leave people to sink or swim on their own, and let the free market look after it, which is the same message coming from Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson and most of the politicians in America. And it's a message that is not palatable in the end. And they're going to suffer for it electorally. And unfortunately, the people in those suburbs, in the Corn Belt and the Rust Belt, they're going to suffer for it as well.
Well, final question to you, Mustafa Traoré. Macron, he has said he is going to be the president of all the French in the next 5 years. What do you see that will lead him down that road in its success, in terms of the success rate here or its failure? How would you rank that?
I think that we all know Macron. He never sticks to his words. So, of course, he's going to be the president of all French citizens. This is officially, this is his position now. But the thing is that is he going to work for the interests of all French citizens? This is another question.
Very well, we'll end it there. Thank you very much for that. Mustafa Traoré, academic and political commentator from Paris. Ian Williams, a pleasure. International affairs analyst from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Vitafoy and the team, it's goodbye.